The meaning of dandelions. From The Secret Language of Plants. By Andrina. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 10. The Beginning of Adulthood. Harry was starting to think that maybe he had been cursed with immortality, and later in life he would be bemoaning the inevitable deaths of all his loved ones as he saw them all grow old and die one by one. The boy who lived, indeed, a killing curse at age 1, another at age 14, almost 15, not that it mattered, and now a fall from 200 meters, and not even bruises to show. He didn't even know how he had done it. He had fallen. He hadn't had time to get his wand out, not that it would have helped, since he hardly knew what spell he could cast to stop the fall. He had fallen. And then he had gotten up on trembling knees and shaken the grass from his trousers unscathed. The wand in his back pocket and the Walkman on his wrist perfectly intact. The grass there had been thick, but not so thick that it could have broken the fall. Thick enough, though, to hide the ripples in the earth, 30 meters in diameter, that extended from the place where he had crashed. Harry shook his head, adjusted his glasses, and walked away humming softly to himself. Nettle's leaf, safe to touch as long as you hold your breath, to symbolize life and death and protection, which felt rather adequate given current events. Dandelions, of course, in addition to being edible and a good diuretic, meant overcoming hardship, such as escaping the school you had been forced to go to, and surviving a fall, if you needed an example. And Snowdrop, actual name Galanthus, the milk flower which acted as an antidote to Circe's poison, to signal hope. Altogether, they said, to have hope, as all perils had been overcome, more or less. He wasn't sure about the exact distribution, but Harry was confident that the message would be understood despite the limitations. Sending a message, actually, that could only come from him was all the situation required. The plants had the advantage of being available in any field and country road, which was rather more convenient than going to a shop and buying a bag of lily seeds to say that he was alive. He had lost all of his money in the crash anyway, and his spare clothes, the jumper, the backpack with supplies. He had a comb, though, the single belonging he had found when hurriedly leaving the place. It was stupid because his hair was uncombable, and he didn't know why he had decided to take it with him. Perhaps because so far it was the only comb he hadn't broken. Such a good, brave comb deserved to accompany him on his adventure. He walked cross-country to the second group of lights he found. The first was such an obvious place to seek refuge, he discarded it immediately. He had no idea if crash survivals were a common thing with wizards, but they probably were. He remembered Neville saying that's how they discovered he was not a squib after all, so if someone expected him to survive the fall, of course they would look in the closest settlement. Harry stood clear of that one and walked to the next village. He had to go to a public library to get some pen and paper with which to write, and then he didn't even have a canut to get an owl. Not that he felt like showing his face in a wizarding pub to request one, so he had to go and stand in an uninhabited area and wait until he found a couple of owls trusting enough to come to him and convince them to please, if they would be so kind, carry these messages for him. All they asked in return was for him to scratch them between the ears, which he was happy to do and, in fact, would have done even if they refused. It wasn't until much later that Harry thought that perhaps this was unusual behavior for common owls. No one had ever explained in Care of Magical Creatures whether wizards used a special magical breed of owls or not. It was all beasts with fangs and claws and stings. Going home would be harder now. He had lost his broom, and he had learned that the Ministry wasn't playing around. He would have to be more cautious from now on. Bragg apparated with a loud pop, and the moor and the hem of her robe instantly caught in the heather and ripped. She had been officially reprimanded and relegated to the most miserable legwork of the office because, as she had suspected, calling your boss a trollhand, dawlish, and setting fire to your boss's shoes, Umbridge, was not well received in the Ministry. At least that funny Auror Tonks came by her desk and invited her for a pint later in the pub, which was very nice because usually Aurors didn't even look at them. So Bragg would rather be done with this soon, pop back to London and get a good pint and a friendly ear to commiserate. She really didn't know what was wrong with the world anymore, but she had not come to the Ministry to be hunting down teenagers. She had ideals. It had all been about protecting muggles from magic misuses, and maybe one day, if she passed the physical exams, joining the Aurors. For now, she was back to the lowest assignments, currently checking for a case of underage magic in the middle of nowhere. No, really, either they had given her the directions wrong, wouldn't put it past them, or someone had come to the moors in North York, performed a conjuration, and then left. presumably accompanied by an adult that had not been present for the previous conjuration. The information was so vague they didn't even have a full name of the offender. Halfway up the short hill there was a simple stone cottage. Bragg walked over there, wand high in her right hand and the lower part of her robes folded on her left arm. She did not make a dignified figure, and she should probably invest in some nice trousers or leggings to wear under the robes. After she knocked on the door, she was greeted by a middle-aged, closer to old, man with a ridiculous beard. It wasn't the longest nor the bushiest beard Bragg had ever seen. She had gone to Hogwarts, she had met Hagrid, all right? But there was something about it that attracted attention. Perhaps that there was much more beard than face, and the fact that it originated so high on the cheek.
"Ah, a tourist," said the owner of the beard. "How you lost, dear? Were you hiking?"
I... Was this a muggle? Bragg didn't know. The man smiled under the beard and invited her in. Bragg stepped into the cottage, dazed. It was one of the traditional single-room cottages with the kitchen and the bedroom all in the same space.
"I was just preparing supper,"
the old man informed her, going back to the little kitchen and singing softly while he stirred something hot and spicy in the pot. Bragg inspected the room quickly while the man had his back turned to her, looking for any clues as to his magical status, which seemed to be null.
"Would you like some stew? It has potatoes,"
he offered, inordinately pleased at the addition of potatoes to his dinner. Bragg realized she hadn't caught his name. "No, that's all right, Mr.
Ah, bread!"
he exclaimed as he opened the kitchen cabinet, which contained a loaf of bread and, inexplicably, a toothbrush with a frog-shaped handle.
"I wonder if there's also wine. It is a bit chilly outside, don't you think? A glass would do us good. Red wine, I think."
"Yes, actually, no, thank you, not for me. I was hiking, yes, hiking with my cousins, but I think I may be a bit behind. See, you haven't seen any children around?"
"Children?"
"More like teenagers, perhaps?" The man stopped to ponder, tugging at his beard with gusto and biting on his lower lip.
"You know, I don't think I have seen anyone."
He hooked a grey curl on his finger.
"But I did hear some noise a while ago. Didn't think much of it. The McAllister kids are always running around these hills."
"That must have been them. Thank you." Bragg headed to the door. "Did you hear what they were saying, by any chance?" The man thought again. For a second his eyes shone green and impish with the reflection of the fire.
"It's typical children stuff. Something about a misplaced nagle, I think."
No, dear, Bragg's day was going to be long. She thanked him and made to leave, although she stayed some more minutes while the man insisted in searching for some wine and a windbreaker to give her. It was still a bit cold this year, spring barely making itself known yet. There was no wine, but he did find the raincoats, one green and one yellow, in between a jar of honey and two onions. Considering he lived in such a little house, he didn't seem to have the faintest idea of what he kept in the cabinets. Bragg left, zipping the yellow windbreaker, thinking that she would patrol a bit around the hill, and if she didn't find any teenagers within the hour, she would call it a night. Whatever a nargle was, the people from the magical creatures department could deal with it. Did you know that if an underage witch or wizard performs magic while in the company of other wizards, the ministry's imposed trace isn't activated? They wouldn't have time for anything else if it weren't so. Harry had discovered this rule last year, although he had only just realized its full potential. It explained why no one came to his rescue when he was in that graveyard, and why there was no record of the couple of good charms he had managed to perform there, which would have given some credibility to his statement that Voldemort had returned. Nope, no record. You did magic in front of an adult. The trace assumed the adult would know how to deal with it as long as they weren't muggles. Awareness on the adult's part that you were doing the magic wasn't a requisite either. Fancy that. Harry thought that if his father were alive, if he could see him, he would be quite proud. Harry felt proud, which was a new feeling regarding magic. Also, although he had not managed to produce any wine, he did have honey and plenty of bread. Breakfast tomorrow was assured. It was a simple trick, really. It took time and focus, but to Harry it was so much easier than any other magic. First, he chose a place, somewhere where the terrain was even and there were no muggles around. It was not strictly necessary, but it was a good idea to walk around a square and get a sense of the space. Then he stepped aside and closed his eyes. He breathed slowly and deeply. He found a point of calm, a point of balance, like that perfect moment before leaning over his broom and dashing through the wards out of Hogwarts. Then, the music. A charming accented voice with the background of violins that softly sets the stage. Harry didn't move, not yet, not until the heavy percussion of cutlery began to mark the rhythm. Then yes, take 3 steps to the right and slide to the left. 3 steps and slide, repeat and turn, and by then the ground would be transforming, and his next steps would sound harder, and Harry would be dancing over a wooden floorboard platform in the middle of nowhere. The walls came with the choir, brick or stone depending on the occasion, rising to the music and the dance and acquiring paint while the song went on. The curtains fell down as the high female voices chanted up. The bass lines of the choir brought the furniture, wooden tables and chairs in the door frames, and Harry kept dancing, and he never bumped into them, not even once. He knew the house layout, even if the house was different each time. At the end of the chorus, the roof fell over the structure with a soft thud, but Harry didn't look up to the rafters that were quickly arranging and settling by themselves. Head down, he mimicked the sad tale of the servants who were not serving, singing dramatically, if not quite with the Gaelic accent. It was a moment of quiet before his body jumped again with the music, and Mrs. Potts's kind voice filled the kitchen cabinets. The spoons circled and flew around Harry before taking their place in the drawers. The forks marched in military formation. Harry danced and danced and turned, and was not at all surprised that he was conjuring a furnished house out of thin air. The best part was at the end, when all the voices came together and Harry created in quick succession the bed, the mattress, the sheets, and on 2 glorious occasions a couch and a fireplace. The chairs ran to take their positions. The table jumped to let a carpet slide below, and there was a sense of rush to get the smaller details. A glass in the bathroom with a red toothbrush, paper towels in the kitchen, even a pair of pajamas and slippers next to the bed. It was at this time that the cabinet started to produce food, usually behind the closed doors, so Harry never knew what he would find until he went to look. But it was always something good. It had to be with that song, didn't it? It had to be the very best food. The knock came, as usual, barely a few minutes after the song ended. Harry had to quickly shove away and animate a pair of salt shakers, who were dancing the twist by themselves, before passing a hand over his face to put on a disguise and opening the door to the friendly special operator of the night alerted to some underage magic. If it was the tired woman again, the one with the freckles, Harry would insist she get some dinner with him. She really looked very tired, and like this was not her best week. Harry now had a rather nice green windbreaker in a small backpack in which he could put the jar of honey and bread. He also had some muggle money because he found a charm of magpies, and after greeting them, they all decided to bring Harry something. Some coins, but also a few bills, plus 3 cans tabs, one of them blue. Animals were awesome. Yet, for all Harry liked animals, he knew very little of them. He had yet to realize that their behavior with him was not normal, that animals steered clear of human contact. With this money, Harry was able to buy a bus ticket that left him a day and a half away from home. He didn't mind walking. He even went a bit cross-country and saw a few other animals. A fox and a couple of rabbits and a deer who came close and let themselves be petted. The deer licked Harry's elbow before wandering away. Harry slept in an old mill and rose early to do the last trek home. He was getting back home. Harry's palms were sweaty and his heart started beating fast. He had a tick in his eye. He just couldn't believe he was so close, even if he understood that he couldn't stay, that they would find him there. Just seeing the familiar road did something in his chest. He needed to see it. He knew it was dangerous and probably stupid, but he needed to see the place where he had been happy. Harry may or may not be on the beginning stages of a transformation into an unholy immortal creature that one day would burn the world. He needed to remind himself that there had been a time of innocence and happiness and sun. He needed to see something that told him that it was not a destiny, but a choice, always a choice. And then a figure came across his path as he left the trail behind.
"And where do you think you're going?"
Not home, apparently. Harry did not get to the cottage. They were going east, to the place where Remus and Harry used to live. Remus thought Harry might be there, and Sirius hadn't contradicted him in a single thing since they heard. But first came the question. Draco had been expecting it earlier, to be honest. It was one thing to help him out of the forest, where the special operators and his father were nearby. It was another to keep Draco around the rest of the time. So was there anyone with whom Draco wanted to be? Draco should be safe. They could take him wherever he wanted. They said that the trip was too dangerous, that they were wanted men. Draco didn't say he wanted to stay with them, because that would be pathetic. But he did say that it would also be dangerous for Harry, wouldn't it? So they didn't have to send him away. Please, even if they didn't find Harry, please don't make him go. Sirius looked at Remus and shrugged, as if silently agreeing with his logic.
"But do you have any relatives? Anyone with whom you would like to stay?" asked Remus.
"What about godparents?"
"There is Aunt Insidia,"
Draco said reluctantly. He only answered because he was too proud to beg to show any need.
"She's my godmother."
Again, Sirius and Remus shared a look.
Not Insidia Malfoy?
Yes, she's my father's aunt or great-aunt, I think. He insisted on her being my godmother.
She must be well over 100 years by now,
guessed Sirius. Not to mention a horrible person, added Remus, which was a surprise because he always seems to be polite.
Horrible, yeah. Very close to my mother, Sirius agreed.
I don't think you should go with her, Draco, Remus said, almost chastising, when excuse him, but he was the one who wanted to send Draco away. Of course, Draco didn't want to go live with the demented viper, and she would send him right back to his father in any case, and he did not want to go back.
What?
Remus seemed very surprised.
What? No, Draco, dear, no, I meant, we are wanted criminals. You are too young. You should be in a proper house with a family. It's not right for us to drag you around, putting you in danger.
Oh, so it wasn't about getting rid of Draco, but about being noble and offering him an out. He should have guessed it. They were old Gryffindors.
Do you not know who my family is?
Asked Draco very seriously. Perhaps the point passed right over their heads.
They're Death Eaters.
Draco said the word with far more teeth than was required. Remus snorted and Sirius barked out a laugh. All right, then, they certainly couldn't be worse than that. So it was that simple. Sirius laughed again and patted Draco on the back affectionately.
So who is your godfather?
Asked Sirius later, as they sat in a cart taking them from Durham to York. The three goblins traveling with them had alighted at the last stop, and the only other occupant was a snoring half-troll.
Not, answered Draco.
Well, he plays the part sometimes. He's very good friends with my father.
But it's not him.
No, my mole insisted on choosing a cousin of hers, Regulus. Regulus Black, who came to the christening gloriously drunk and said his gift for Draco was that he wished him a good family. Lucius had been furious, but less so because he got to choose the godmother, and so he was able to pass over Bella. In any case, Regulus got himself killed soon after, so what Sirius got out of this story was that obviously he was Draco's godfather now, having inherited the responsibility from his deceased brother. He poked Remus in the side with his finger until the poor man awoke from his nap, and Sirius informed him of his recently discovered godfathership. Remus congratulated him formally and went back to sleep.
Oh, this is splendid. Harry's my godson, too. You can be god siblings if you want. Although, I don't know if that's a thing. I'll ask, don't worry. Anyway, do you fly? Do you play Quidditch?
I'm a seeker, said Draco, perhaps starting to see why Remus hadn't thought them to be the best possible legal tutors. He had thrown words like balance and routine as if stability were the most sought virtue.
Just like Harry, then, Sirius beamed. Well, I'll have to buy you a broom. A child's first broom should come from the godfather. I also bought Harry's, you know. I can teach you how to shave and drink. That's very important, Draco. You have to learn how to control your drink and not to get plastered unless you want to. But you shouldn't want to get drunk, because it leads to terrible magical accidents. Why, our third cousin Taurus.
Sirius was... Draco didn't want to say crazy, because Longbottom had made sure everyone forgot that word. And it wasn't insane, either. Sirius's attitude seemed quite healthy to him, but he was mad. He chattered constantly and had the strangest ideas. He was excited and enraptured by the most common things. In the last pub where they were served an abysmal dinner, Sirius declared that it was the worst omelette he'd ever tasted, and he did so with a smile, as if experiencing bad things could be good. Draco quite liked him. Sirius made them stop to see a bunch of sparrows demolish a small piece of bread. So then Draco didn't feel very self-conscious when he unconsciously stopped to listen to a street musician fumbling with his guitar. Sirius and Remus stopped with him and let him listen for as long as he wanted with not a word of complaint. Draco was spoiled, but he also wasn't used to getting what he wanted. Of Remus, Draco didn't still have an opinion. He felt that he still hadn't met the man. He had seen him briefly in the forest and on their way to that strange first inn, nonchalant before danger and polite on all occasions, with a very target-focused mind. But since then, Remus had been quiet and acting like he was behind a mask. A mask that said Harry wasn't dead, he was fine, and so Remus wasn't losing his mind with worry. Frankly, Draco was the most stable of the three of them. There was a Ford Fiesta parked in the outskirts of town, in the wide area people used to turn the cars around. Next came the narrow road that would take them to the cottage near the top of a small hill. It was well past 5 already. No one would be using the road at this time. The lights of the Ford Fiesta blinked twice. Remus stopped, and behind him, Sirius and Draco did the same. They took the first street to the left. A minute later they heard the engine of a car coming closer. 20 steps and they were between brick walls and gardens with no windows looking to this side of the street. The Ford Fiesta stopped, the engine idling, and a woman rolled down the driver's window.
"Did you know Freddo's cost 20p now?"
Sirius and Draco shared a look. They did not know that. They didn't know who or what a Freddo was and why its price was relevant. 20 pence didn't sound like much. Was a pence the same as a canut?
"What?"
Remus exclaimed.
"Merlin's beard, what's wrong with the world?"
"It's you,"
the woman said. It didn't sound like she was accusing Remus of being the cause of everything wrong with the world, though. She was smiling as she said it. Sirius noticed she had a nice smile and reddish-brown hair down to her shoulders.
"Come on in."
They got inside the car, Remus to her side and Sirius and Draco behind, their knees comically high because the car did not have much room. Draco fidgeted a bit and produced a pen, a Sudoku book, and a crumpled flyer from his seat.
"They've been stuck in the house for the last 5 days,
the woman said as she drove down the street.
"Teresa, and I saw your boy 2 days ago.
What? Oh my God, was he all right?"
The relief in Remus's voice was like a waterfall.
"You saw Harry?"
Sirius said it, sounding like a thirsty man who just heard running water. Draco didn't speak, but he exhaled and let his head drop back in the seat. She drove them out of the village to a wide, flat area between the trees a few miles away. There was half a stone wall that may have belonged to a chapel or a stable. So little remained, it was hard to tell. In the trip there, she informed them, or rather Remus, that someone called Eddie was in London on a full scholarship and was studying design because he wanted to work on something called animation, and she couldn't be more proud. And Olivia was on the football team and doing well in school and had been so mad learning that Harry had been there, but she couldn't see him. Harry was all right, too. God, how much he had grown. All of this was said in the same breath of air. She got out of the car and indicated they should do the same. They walked past the stone wall to the edge of the trees. From there, they could see the hilltop and a bit of the house emerge between the trees and the bushes. It was difficult to see the house from that far. They had made sure it would be so. She pointed.
"There are 4 people stationed there at all times, with a 5th one randomly moving around, and I think they put some sort of alarm. They definitely came and did something about 3 years ago."
"That would be when we got out of Azkaban," said Remus, looking back at Sirius.
"You what?"
The woman, Teresa, looked shaken. Her right arm was still frozen in the air where she was pointing.
"Not the place with the soul-sucking monsters?"
"Yes." She lowered her arm and swallowed.
"Oh, come here," she said,
as she drew Remus into a hug. It was a good hug, long and tight. Precisely the kind of hug that would draw nightmares away. They stepped back, although they were still grabbing each other's arms.
"That's not right," she said. "It's not. Harry told me what happened. Were you there too?"
It took Sirius a few seconds to realize she was talking to him now. He said yes, just as Remus said so, and made some introductions, but Sirius didn't get to hear what Remus was saying about him because the woman embraced him too, and Sirius was overwhelmed by the smell of her hair and her skin and the warmth that came from her. It wasn't sexual. Although it had been a very long time since he had had a woman in his arms, and he was very aware of the press of her breasts and her thighs against his body, it was just being recognized as a human, being comforted. Draco got a hug, too, and 2 loud kisses, because although he hadn't been in Azkaban, no child, yes, you are a child, and don't make that face. No child should have to live through this. There had been wizards when they took Harry. Half the village had been obliviated, and the other half had quickly feigned ignorance because they were muggles, not idiots. People had been scared. Scared of the men in hoods and the power they held. Scared of the silence that surrounded the cottage now. They couldn't help noticing that the animals were avoiding it. No bird sat on the stones of the wall or perched on the roof. People had been scared, but they remembered. Then 2 years later, the men in hoods had returned and done something around the cottage. They figured it was some kind of alarm. People had specifically prohibited the kids from going nearby, so of course they had taken to going there and throwing rocks and sticks and then running on their bikes a good distance before looking back. For the most part, nothing happened, but a couple of times they claimed to have seen something, movement. Olivia had hit a wizard with a can of Coke. She knew perfectly well what she had done, but she claimed innocence and that she thought it was a wild boar, and anyway, if they were hiking, they should wear reflective vests. Everybody knew that. What kind of normal person didn't know that? They hadn't seen much of them after that, and eventually the kids had grown bored with setting off the alarm. But about a week ago, the men had returned. Four men and two women dressed in formal suits and wearing bright yellow reflective vests on top. People knew by then that it was better to act as if everything was perfectly normal. They were charging them double in the pub, though. So the villagers weren't examining too close what the presence of these strangers meant, because answers probably carried nasty consequences, but they were making a point of being as obtrusive as possible without talking about it. Teresa had intercepted Harry just a couple of days ago, fed him lunch, and helped him get away. Since then, she had been on the lookout for Remus, knowing he too would come.
He said he was planning on going to the summer house.
What's the summer house?
I haven't the faintest.
Better if I can't tell, innit? Teresa couldn't help them more than that. Whatever money she had to spare, she had given it to Harry, but they all assured her she had done more than enough. She hugged them all, and that in itself was a feast. They left, hiding in the twilight. It wasn't far to the next village. Sirius had the impression that there may have been something going on between Remus and Snape, the way Remus talked of him. But then again, people don't just face half a dozen auras to warn you and help you escape and give you whatever help they can, so maybe there was something there too. Sirius would like to know, because if for whatever reason Remus was not interested, well, Sirius would just like to get to know her better, is all. They spent the night inside the offices of the train station. Not the best place, but dry and warm enough. Draco looked around at the small, dusty place, and his face adopted an expression that seemed to say that he finally understood why they had insisted on sending him away to an actual house. This was not a comfortable place to spend the night. But he didn't complain. He didn't complain. And he didn't look like he was just quietly bearing it down, either. He smiled. He joked. He looked at Sirius with a mixture of amusement and admiration, and genuinely looked like someone who was in love. He shone. His nose and the point of his ears got a bit red with cold sometimes. Spring had been cancelled this year, and he had developed some red burns from the rugs and coarse beds they had slept in. Draco's skin was ridiculously delicate, on his arms and on his cheeks. The latter was harder to see, given the angry red marks Lucius Malfoy had put there. Those were just starting to fade. Remus was reminded of a toddler who didn't cry for his mum. When he looked at Draco, positively blooming under their hard conditions, Remus found that he really needed to brew a cup of tea, or two or three.
"So where'd you go during summers?"
asked Sirius, yawning enormously. "Nowhere. The cottage had multiple protections, and during the first year there were threats to Harry," answered Remus as he double-checked the windows.
"So the summer house?"
The summer house. Harry had realized that he had to pass him a message that if intercepted no one else could understand. Excellent thinking, well done, but he had been a tad obscure. The summer house? "I am not sure to what it refers," Remus admitted. "Could be a number of things. The cottage was the house." Even though the message was meant for Remus, a code that only he could know, Sirius and Draco decided to help. Or Sirius did. And after listening to his rambling suggestions, Draco took control of the conversation. Draco was smart. Not to say that Sirius wasn't, because Sirius was very intelligent. The map would never have taken form if it weren't for Sirius's proficiency with charms. But intelligence is not the same as smarts, and Draco had a sharp mind that made connections quickly. It was while he was shutting down all of Sirius's suggestions without waiting for Remus to confirm them, to be fair, by then Sirius had taken it as a joke and was just throwing ideas out to see if anything rang a bell, when Draco stopped and turned to Remus with narrowed eyes.
"You didn't transform in that cottage, did you?"
"I will have thought, Draco,"
Sirius said while he licked the oil from a can of tuna that had made their dinner.
"Could Harry have gone to your accomplices?"
What gods had Remus offended that Sirius had to say those words while wriggling his eyebrows? Remus frowned at Sirius. This was better than the "Oh my God" snivellus he had been subjected to for 2 months, nearly three, but just barely.
"It could be. He did visit that house mostly during summer months.
But there was also an Elizabethan house in Plymouth, a museum house they had visited during their summer trips to the sea, and just a bit inland, in Exeter, there was the house that moved, which Harry found very interesting, even if the house was moved by people rather than by itself. Any of them could be the summer house, how to know? By the intake of breath and widening of eyes, Draco was having a realization.
"There was no mention of an accomplice. Nothing at all in the papers," exclaimed Draco. "Not even my father remarked on it."
His eyes moved around the room, unseeing, his pretty little Slytherin brain coming up with a list of suspects and quickly narrowing it down to less than a dozen. McGonagall was one of his top candidates.
"I need to know, who was it? Was it a woman?"
"Draco, I can't tell you. As you've already well observed,
No one knows this person's identity, and I would like it to remain that way. It is Harry's last shield. Draco nodded, understanding. He also had a combined look of dejection and relish for the puzzle. He didn't mind not being told, but he did mind being told he couldn't even guess. For safety.
Don't take it personally, said Sirius, speaking just as one did when in class, out of the corner of the mouth and with his eye to the front. He wouldn't tell me either. If I hadn't learned it by accident, I dare say he wouldn't have told me at all.
Oh, well, in that case, I will figure it out, promised Draco. They walked. There were times when they dared take a bus, muggle or wizarding, but until they knew exactly where they had to go, they walked and kept low. Remus pondered the riddle, and Sirius continued his self-appointed education of Draco. In the background, Remus could hear him tell Draco all the dirty laundry of his family, every quirk, secret, and perversion of the House of Black, but also all of the other families associated with it. He did not have much to say of the Malfoys, because they were better than others at guarding their secrets, but he did have a lot to say of the Bulstrodes and the Carrows, and so much of the Lestranges and Macmillans. It was a nice background noise, Sirius chattering animatedly after so many years with no emotion, and Draco sounding outraged or sick or shocked or amused, but generally just sounding free. Free to talk and free to show his emotions. What a lovely sound. There had been a bit of a faint drizzle earlier that day, but now the sun was shining despite the clouds, white light in a dark gray sky. Harry used to stop and look at the houses when the light was like this, said it was a time for good ideas. Remus thought, what a peculiar way of thinking Harry had. But Harry had trusted him that he would know precisely that he would understand what no one else could. He had to think like Harry, then. Harry, who seems to have quite a bit of a poet's soul at times. He was so emotional that things changed around him, and color and music escaped from his mind. He had been so sad, Severus said in the little space of his letters. So sad, yet twice he had managed to cast a Patronus. He had come to the cottage after leaving Hogwarts, the cottage he knew had been torn apart. The romantic in Harry would wait in a meaningful place. But then again, Harry had grown to be eminently practical. He won the Triwizard Tournament barely using magic, although Severus thought and Remus agreed that Crouch had had something to do with it. He escaped Hogwarts on a broom and then again escaped the special operators. He would not cross the country to wait in a symbolic place. He would not risk himself, and he would certainly not risk Remus making the trip. Harry would go somewhere close and somewhere safe. And just like that, he got it. Remus remembered. It was a bit like the say friend and enter thing.
Mysterious Encounters in Yorkshire, by Betty Braithwaite.
Ministry reports and witnesses' statements account for a most mysterious event that occurred on the afternoon of Tuesday in South Yorkshire. Martha Rigglebottom, 36, a vivacious and imaginative witch, and Harry Periwinkle, 35, a promising wizard working in the Flu Network Authority and member of the Periwinkle family, reportedly suffered a most unfortunate and baleful attack in the afternoon this past Tuesday the 11th, as they went for a stroll through the most picturesque trails of South Yorkshire. Martha Rigglebottom and Harry Periwinkle reported encountering six hooded figures who, under the limited light of the evening, seemed to be standing with wands drawn above the stirring body of a Muggle man, Reginald Hopkins, 42. Mr. Hopkins had already been obliterated before this report could get his statement. Henry Periwinkle, a competent and industrious young wizard, claims not to recall clearly what happened next. Martha Rigglebottom, an inventive and spirited half-blood witch, claims that the hooded figures inquired about their Hogwarts houses and blood status, and that upon learning them, cast a series of curses, mostly directed at Miss Rigglebottom. This newspaper reminds its readership that the account of the events may have been exaggerated. Martha Rigglebottom was hit by a liver corpus spell, while Henry Periwinkle lost his wand due to an Expelliarmus. It was while he was kneeling between the bushes looking for his wand and strategically deciding his next move that he spotted a mysterious figure, dressed in green, appearing suddenly in the middle of the trail. Neither Periwinkle nor Rigglebottom remember clearly the mysterious man's appearance, but Henry Periwinkle assures us that he was decidedly old and unattractive, while Martha Rigglebottom says she is quite certain that he was tall and most definitely not brunette. It was at this time that the mysterious man asked about the events he had interrupted and about the state of the Muggle. The hooded figures, according to Martha Rigglebottom, demanded to know his house and blood status, which the man refused to provide. This elicited a cursing response that nevertheless had no effect on the man, as no spell managed to hit him. This См together with the man's calm response, asking them to please dispose of their wands, suggest that despite Miss Wrigglebottom's dramatic account, it may have been a bit of a joking affair, with no nefarious purpose whatsoever.
"It was all quite nonsensical,"
says the collected and level-headed Henry Periodwinkle on what happened next.
"He started to talk about his friend Steve, while snapping his fingers, and he seemed to think that the story was very interesting. Asked if we were paying attention, but he never got to tell it."
Mr. Periodwinkle can't recall if he had recovered his wand at this point. He says that he retired a few steps from the scene, the most sensible thing to do at the time, given that the Ministry does not approve of or recommend engaging in violent action. Mr. Periodwinkle thus demonstrated his aplomb in tense situations and his attention to Ministry policies. According to Mr. Periodwinkle, the mysterious man claimed that another one was biting the dust, even though no one had done anything yet, certainly not biting or chewing of any kind. Miss Wrigglebottom, for her part, tells us that after some more finger-snapping on the part of the mysterious man, the six-footed men started to shake and drop to the ground and kept falling over each other. He, the mysterious man, pointed at the biggest one and told him that he was going to get him too, and that's when he went flying backwards and at the tree. Although Ministry officials were not able to arrest or identify these supposed hooded figures, they did manage to retrieve multiple pieces of black cloth from the nearby bushes and tree branches. Miss Wrigglebottom says that at some point, they all ended up head down and tangled in the vegetation, whereas Henry Periodwinkle says that they seemed to have lost all sense of balance and were unable to stay upright. Mr. Periodwinkle says that it was at this moment that he finally recovered his wand and speedily apparated away to alert official authorities of the event. Martha Wrigglebottom, who remained behind, helped the muggle recover, and together with the mysterious man, walked down to the nearest village. She stayed in the company of the distressed muggle until the arrival of the Ministry wizards, brought by Mr. Periodwinkle's quick thinking. Interrogated at the scene, Miss Wrigglebottom could not give more details of the mysterious man, other than he said his name was Obiwanke Nobi, which leads this reporter to believe that he might have been foreign.
There was a boy with long black hair sitting on a bench. He was wearing a green windbreaker and had a backpack between his feet, broken white and leather. He was sitting, waiting, and there was something so very peaceful about the scene, as if time reduced its march and went slower, treading around him with gentle feet. He was in Leeds. Leeds is a very interesting location, right in the middle between the north and the south, and yet there is hardly anything magical about the place. It is not like Oxford with its apothecaries, or Manchester and its wizarding pub scene. Leeds is muggle, just as Liverpool, a normal city with its stores and sights, as cities usually possess. Because it did not have much of a wizarding community, and because for some reason it never attracted interest despite its location, maybe the centralness of it somehow pushed wizards away, maybe it was magical in an inverse way. And Harry had visited it quite a few times as a child. They had done what you do when you live in the country and go to a big city, walk around and visit museums and do a lot of shopping. Harry supposed Remus had also been getting some important things and running adult errands, perhaps doing something at a bank. He couldn't quite remember. All he knew was that Harry used to own a grey and orange sweater and that it was bought there, and that once, when he was 7, maybe, he had seen a house with its front painted a bold yellow, and Harry had thought that you could only live there during summer. How could you stay in that house during autumn or winter? It was so yellow. It did not make much sense, but it was the kind of thought children have, like the time Olivia convinced him to try eating grass because if cows ate it, maybe it was tasty. The boy sat on the bench in front of the yellow house. It was funny, because as they walked by, most people simply saw a boy, but some others, people with funny clothes and funny names and funny things hidden in their pockets, people that rarely went to Leeds, saw something else entirely. They saw a man with a ridiculous gray beard that covered most of his face, or a man with a long, curled black mustache, or a lanky fellow with straight blonde hair and a short billy-goat beard. They saw plenty of faces, and no one could say if it was the boy or it was them performing that magic, just as no one could say if Leeds was muggle, or has the kind of magic that pushed other magic away. The boy didn't know how long he would have to wait. Truth be told, he had no way of knowing that he had to wait, other than a solid faith that the news of his leaving would reach his dad, and that he would come get him. He didn't mind waiting, though. He could listen to music, and when he grew hungry, he ate a slice of bread with honey. He waited a whole day, and when night came, he left a small tower of pebbles on the bench to mark his presence and went to find somewhere to sleep. Usually, people looking for a place to spend the night would go to a back alley, smelly and also no cover from the elements, merely a place to be out of sight,
or to a station. After a few hours, someone would ask to see your ticket and kick you out. Or to a homeless refuge. No idea where to find one, but Harry was 15, closer to 16 now, and therefore had a youthful look. And although he was very disheveled, he did not smell terribly bad. He did not look homeless yet. So he walked to the university campus, blessedly situated downtown, and found a quiet place in the library and spent the night there, the sobs of the medical students lulling him to sleep. He was not the smelliest, nor the most disheveled there, and he got a free lollipop, cherry-flavored. He went back to his writing end in the evening. He had to wait no more.
"Well," said Sirius, his hands on his hips and his head craned back, "it certainly is a very yellow house."
"Even the flower pots are yellow," pointed Draco aghast.
"So what now, do we knock? Is he inside?"
"Of course not, Sirius. He's not inside. We don't know who lives here. We'll have to look around." They examined the front of the house for any clues. Something that wasn't yellow, perhaps. Draco kept mumbling the things that were painted yellow, the mailbox, the door handle, the curtains. That was not of much use. Not that they were able to find anything.
"Perhaps we could just ask if they'd seen him."
"Sirius, we are not knocking on the door. It's a muggle house, and we shouldn't disturb them."
"I just really want to know who lives in a house like this. Who goes one day and decides to paint every single feature of the facade yellow?"
"People have strange tastes. Don't you have a cousin who does the same with pink?" "Carpania," said Draco immediately.
"Do you think the inside will also be yellow?"
Sirius went on, standing on tiptoes. His question would go unanswered, other than by what little he could peek through the windows. Seeing as there was no clue in the front of the house, they turned around to look at the surroundings.
"Let's ask the man on the bench," Remus decided.
"The one with the red beard?"
asked Sirius, finally giving his back to the house.
"What? No, the gentleman with the white beard."
"Remus, there's a red-headed fellow right there. Why will we ask the granddad six benches over?"
"And not him. Him and the bench across the street."
"Exactly. And that man has a short red beard."
"Sirius, are you quite all right?"
"That is a man in his 60s with a white beard and he's balding," pointed Remus, quiet and slow, in an obvious effort not to lose his patience.
"Merlin's beard. Is this a werewolf thing? Have you stopped seeing colours all of a sudden?"
Sirius pointed at Remus, the house, and the bench.
"It's the house, isn't it? It's burned your pupils. And now you can only see in black and white."
"Sirius, you're being nonsensical.
I'm not the one who suddenly thinks red hair is white."
"Not to add extra bludges to the game," said Draco. "But in that bench," he pointed for emphasis to the bench directly across the street, "all I see is a black-haired boy."
Sirius and Remus looked at Draco and the man on the bench. Draco narrowed his eyes.
"He kind of looks like Harry from this distance."
Harry had learned enough caution not to jump towards Remus the moment he saw him. He had grown up with Severus, too, after all, and he had recent proof of how one could magically change their appearance. Although had he paid attention in class at any point at all during the last 5 years, perhaps he would have learned that what he was doing was not at all typical. Also, Draco was there, Draco Malfoy. He didn't know if that was an obvious sign of a trap or just the opposite. He rose when they crossed the street toward him. He had to close his hands into fists, his nails digging into the flesh to stop himself from running. He would not fall into a trap. He allowed them to see him, shaking away the thin glamour layer.
"Your best friend growing up was a girl a year older than you named Olivia," said Remus. "You used to play Chedhuysen Knights."
It was him. How to describe the feeling of returning home after a long absence? It is not the sight of the place or the person, because they are often changed. It is a smell. It is a physical memory, reaching for things without thinking, because your body knows where everything is supposed to be. It is the shoulders unclenching, and your mind saying that here, now, is where you can finally sleep. There is no way to describe it, but you can certainly feel it. It was an embrace, longer and tighter than the one Harry had gotten 2 years ago. Harry was still short, so short. He could bury his face in Remus's chest just as when he was a child. He could close his eyes and for a minute let himself believe that everything would be all right, fool himself into thinking that his biggest problem was a math exercise. Their arms tightened against each other, and Harry felt Remus kissing the top of his head. Harry was crying, as he felt the world around him moving, repositioning. It had been tilted down its axis for too long, and only now was it straightening back up. Only now did he feel like he had both feet on the ground. When they pulled apart, Sirius was conspicuously looking at the roofs on the other side of the street, his arm over Draco's shoulders.
Apparently he had thrown himself into a dissertation on chimney design. But he hugged Harry too, his chin trembling a little bit. And later Harry shook Draco's extended hand and pulled him into a terribly awkward half-hug. It was like Draco had no previous experience of hugging Cheese. He didn't question Draco's presence, because despite certain people's allegations of Harry's obliviousness, he could be quite perceptive when it mattered. And then, because the world doesn't really care about your life, even when there is a beautiful and emotional reunion going on, it started to rain for 20 seconds, before upgrading to pouring and possibly a deluge. End of book two. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.